Hey guys, welcome back to the Why Wars Happen History podcast, where you learn about the causes of wars and things like, why did it happen? Was it inevitable? Who was involved? Sometimes I go back hundreds of years just so we can understand what the hell happened. And if you want to talk more about war, we also have authors, historians, war generals, royalty, actors, filmmakers, a whole bunch of people come on as guests, and we talk about everything about war, before, during, and after war. So let's go. Welcome to the Why Wars Happen History podcast, where we sit down with filmmakers and historians and we talk about history. Today's guest is Dr. Alexander S. Burns, historian, author of several books on 18th century warfare, and author of today's book, Infantry in Battle, 1733 to 1783. Alex, thanks for joining us today.
Emily, thanks so much for having me on.
As I mentioned earlier, I kind of discovered you on this rabbit hole down Twitter. I was like, oh my God, this guy does what? He writes about what? So I think it's really cool that we're talking today. And thank you so much for sending me a copy of your book. Man, where to even start? I wanted to mention you write so smoothly. Oh my God. Do you write nonfiction at all? It feels like you would.
Yeah, no, not really. So one of the things as I was going through my PhD and reading a lot of the secondary literature, you know, what other historians have said about the various topics that I am interested in, it's all pretty dense and it's kind of hard to get through. And so I really wanted to try and make my work accessible to like a more general audience. And I think if you ask my wife, she would say, like, I've come a long way in this regard. I used to be pretty bad at this. But in she credits actually me writing so much on Twitter. She thinks I'm terminally online, and she's probably not wrong. And essentially says that trying to write for a more popular audience online has made my academic writing a little bit more accessible. I try not to get into so much of like the jargon and social science ideas that maybe sometimes bog down historical writing.
Yeah, man, as I had mentioned before, just through our correspondence, I read your thesis paper and that was smooth too. I was like, Jesus, this guy, I have to talk.
Thank you. It's very kind of you to say.
Also, I wanted to ask about real quick before we get into kind of the meat of this, that you have all these like battle maps in there. And they're super cool and they're super easy to understand. How did you get all of those battle formations of these really long ago battles?
Sure, absolutely. So I will say I am not myself a cartographer. A lot of that work was done by my publisher, Helene & Company. But for the battles, particularly the chapter on Northern Italy, the battles in 1734 at Parma and Gustula, I kind of like drew a hand sketch and then sent it to the publisher and they made it look a little bit more professional. And essentially what you do as a historian is you try to find like frequently, and in this case, the database that really helped me out or the archive that really helped me out was George III, the king during the American Revolution. He had a huge collection of military maps from the 18th century that he loved to look at. And those are all preserved today. And most of them are digitized online. I went to those maps and I kind of tried to find one that matched up pretty well to what the officers' reports that I was reading was saying. And I sort of sketched my own map based off of those 18th century original battle maps, which are pretty common. They're frequently, like in the 18th century in America, in Italy, in Germany, in England, in the big cities, publishers will like print out little like news, like almost like a newsletter of like, this is what happened in the most recent battle. And usually in one of those newsletters, there's a little map of what, you know, what the publisher thinks at least happened at the end of that. So that can be helpful as well.
That's fantastic. And we know George III was kind of obsessed with reading and books and science and things like that. So that makes a lot of sense. But that is so cool. That's a lot of research that went into that, it seems like. So thanks for putting that in the book. It was really helpful.
I'm glad.
Okay, so let's go a little bit before where you start off with the War of the Polish Succession, which isn't as well known as some of the other wars of succession, but a little bit before the Seven Years' War we're starting out, right? And there's all this tension in Europe and you know, the warfare between these countries and these countries. And it's just like this constant tension. It's almost like too much to keep up with sometimes. But OK, so why start with the War of the Polish Succession? Why is that so important for history of warfare?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's a very good question. And if I could, I'll probably answer this in two parts. One, sort of why I did, and then maybe we can come back later and talk about why, you know, those alliance systems, and there's so much tension in Europe at this time. It's actually something that my scholarly grandfather, like my advisor's advisor, wrote a lot about. And so it's a topic that's near and dear to my heart. But why did I choose to pick this date to start the book? Normally, when you read books about the 18th century, normally if you're an American and you read books of military history of the 18th century, you're looking at the Revolutionary War. Like that's what we like to talk about. That's what we like to focus on. But if you're in Europe, or maybe you're really, really into this as an American, you might read about the French and Indian War or the Seven Years' War. It's a global war, but certainly it also happened here in America. And the part of it that happened here in America is the French and Indian War. In Europe, the tale or the story of this military history is told via the wars of a pretty important North German king or Prussian king called Frederick II or Frederick the Great. And he's one of the, you know, quote unquote, great captains of history. Some people put him up there with like Napoleon in terms of being a great general. And so for a lot of historians, they look at these conflicts and they say, well, what's important? We should focus on the wars that he was involved in, because he's almost like a Napoleon sort of figure. And so we should start the story of war with his reign. And so the first big war that he's involved in is what we often call globally the War of Austrian Succession, or the War of Jenkins here sometimes.
Reference.
he specifically was involved in what the Germans call the First Silesian War, that part of that larger conflict. But what I'm trying to do in this book is write a history of how ordinary soldiers experience battle, and how ordinary soldiers are, you know, moving on the battlefield and using their weapons, and almost like a tactical, you know, history from the perspective of ordinary men. Because really, that's the part of history that I think is the most interesting. I write about a variety of topics. I just yesterday, on the 31st, so 2 days ago, I submitted a chapter that's about like a strategic history of the Seven Years' War, but where the ministers are sending warships and things like this off to an editor who's going to put it into a larger volume. But for a lot of my work, I like writing about the ordinary guys, the people who are not great names that everyone's heard of, like George Washington or John Adams or someone like this, but instead the average Joe who is involved in history at this time. And a lot of these men are foot soldiers in these 18th century wars. And so I'm trying to write this history about how they experience war. And if you look at the important parts of the narrative for them, it doesn't start with the reign of that great Prussian king, Frederick II. Okay. It starts earlier in the War of Polish Succession, which is a dispute over who should be king of Poland. And a result of the European geography and who's on whose side, it's actually mainly a fight between the French and the Austrians, or like southern Germans in northern Italy.
I was going to say that was really interesting where, you know, everybody obviously knows France and Austria were on different sides of the war in World War One. And it was really interesting to see centuries before World War One, you could see these tensions and then eventually this war where they're on the opposite sides, even way back then. And so, you know, it's just kind of interesting. I don't think it's very well known. Like I was saying, like War of Polish Succession, you're like, what?
So, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. No, I mean, at this point, they're big rivals. It's almost like the U.S. and Russia today, or U.S. and China today. Mm-hmm. From the time of an emperor named Charles V, you know, back when like Martin Luther was in Germany, the French and the Austrians have kind of been squaring off. And often, tragically, for the people who live in northern Italy, including some of my ancestors, that was a pretty common battleground for these two almost like European superpowers, if you will, to be showing down in northern Italy.
You know, we do a lot of World War One talks and things like that. So it was kind of, I don't want to say like cool, but it was interesting. So then you move on to Battle of Parma, Battle of Guastalla, and you're in northern Italy, and that's still part of the same war. And I wanted to ask, just to clarify, make sure I'm like, am I getting this right? There was no swordplay whatsoever in those battles?
Yeah, so maybe no is a little strong. Okay. And this is something that we do debate a lot, but repeated, you know, how important were bayonets and sword fighting in these 18th century wars, like close combat, melee combat. But if you read the letters home from the French officers and some of the Austrian or Imperial officers, they say, yeah, you know, we shot at each other all day, but it didn't come to the bayonet. So we, you know, we had a firefight, but we weren't actually fighting close combat hand to hand. And so this is something that is one of my themes in the book. The bayonet's still a really important weapon in the 18th century. It's an incredibly important weapon in the 18th century, but it's mostly a weapon to try and intimidate the enemy, try and scare them away, okay, try and get them to run away rather than killing hundreds of guys by stabbing them with bayonets. Right. So I'm not necessarily in the book trying to say that bayonets don't matter anymore, that close combat doesn't matter, but I do think the threat of it matters a little bit more than the actual violence that happens hand to hand, which is pretty rare in the 18th century.
Right. So, okay, so how common was it, let's say, you know, 1734, how common was it for a battle to not have bayonets and swords and rapiers and, you know, and it's just like pew pew, like how was that common?
Yeah. So at the two big fights that I look at, Parma and Gustula, these are basically firefights. There's not a lot of close quarters fighting. At Gustula, there's a little bit of fighting with the cavalry. Obviously, they're fighting with, you know, sabers and things like this on horseback. In the surprise at Gustula, in between the two battles, you're attacking the enemy camp at night. You're sort of taking them unaware. Maybe bayonet fighting is a little bit more common. On my blog in past years, I've tried to look at this question a little bit more broadly throughout the 18th century. And basically what I found is soldiers will fight in hand-to-hand combat if they're fighting over a defended obstacle. I mean, think about like the Battle of Bunker Hill and the Revolutionary War. So if one side's like in a trench and the other side's out in the open, they're trying to attack the trench. Well, the guys in the trench don't want to run away because then they'll have to leave the advantage of their cover, their protected position. And so then you might have hand-to-hand combat. Likewise, okay, if you surprise an enemy army, like the example that I think a lot of us might immediately jump to is like the Battle of Chancellorsville, when Stonewall Jackson comes out of the trees on Oliver Otis Howard's 11th Corps and you sort of storms into the camp. Maybe there's some bayonet fighting there. That happens in the Seven Years' War at the Battle of Hawkirk in 1758. But if you're not attacking an enemy trench or defensive position, or you're surprising the enemy in their camp or in some other way, it's relatively rare for two bodies of infantry who have the option to stay at maybe 100 yards and fire at each other for them to close in and attack. And indeed, in those battles in northern Italy, there's an absolutely incredible sort of reference or letter from a soldier who was in the Austrian military, who writes home to his family and basically says, our general really wanted our soldiers, who are grenadiers, or like big elite assault troops, almost like rangers in the American army today. He wanted them to go and attack the enemy with bayonets. And basically the troops were like, nah, we're going to stay here. We're going to shoot at them. We don't want to go into close combat. And he's like, you know, hitting them with the flat of his sword and trying to get them to go attack the enemy. And so there's a very adversarial relationship at times between the enlisted men and the officers in the 18th wow. century. The officers are very keen for the soldiers to fight a certain way. And the soldiers are not always keen to be fighting in maybe a more dangerous way. They'd prefer to stay back about 100 yards and keep shooting at the enemy from a distance, a little safer.
Yeah, that's interesting. Like, even at very small bits of it, but even as, again, you know, in World War One, you hear of there's still hand-to-hand combat when everyone's fighting. If you were able to make it into a trench, then you go with the, you know, the knives and the all that stuff. But it seems like around this period, mid-1700s, all that kind of stuff was kind of like this dying, this last gasp of sometimes people fought with swords or, you know, sabers and things like that. It was really kind of like a dying world, which is almost really, it's really sad in a way. I don't know why, but it's almost sad in a way.
Sure, like we're losing something romantic from the past or something like that. Yeah, I mean, I think you definitely still find cavalry soldiers fighting hand-to-hand with their sabers and some of them still wear armor. I mean, some of them will have like a metal band inside their hats. You know, so if you're hit on the top of your head by a sword, it'll like deflect off. Wow. Some of the heavier cavalry are still wearing like breastplates or armored plates at this time, and not just to protect themselves from any swords. They're also like musket proof. So if a soldier were to fire a musket at them, it would deflect off. Wow. But yeah, it is sort of like a like almost like going away or fading into more of obscurity. The officers really don't like this. They're very keen for the soldiers to maybe even like be issued with long spears or pikes again. They want to try and bring hand-to-hand combat back. But in many ways, the soldiers are the ones who are saying, "Nah, we're good. We don't want to go up and stab somebody. That's a very psychologically demanding task. Going up and stabbing someone, face to face, right there. It's much easier to shoot at someone from a distance psychologically."
That's a good point.
Yeah, if you ever wonder, why are soldiers taught to, scream as they're bayoneting someone? It's not to terrify the guy. The guy's already terrified. He's about to get stabbed. You're trying to release this incredible amount of like stress and tension that you feel as the guy who's stabbing someone else.
Almost dissociate yourself from it. Like,
yeah, exactly. Not wanting to fight in close combat is a pretty standard thing. You see it through a lot of these early modern or even wars like the American Civil War, and it's certainly kind of cut that issue, a problem, maybe as the officers would have addressed it, is definitely there in the wars that I'm looking at.
I was going to ask about that too, where, you mentioned sometimes about how some of the officers just really didn't want to let this hand-to-hand combat go. They really didn't want to. Bayonets are more predictable than running out of ammo, soldiers firing too soon, all this, the lack of accuracy. And it was kind of like, it seemed like these two worlds of these officers in their own world wanting something, and then kind of the more reality on the battlefield of like, we're not going to use my bayonet. And the other thing that I thought was really interesting too is that you mentioned, so back then, Italy was just a bunch of kingdoms. It wasn't Italy as a country yet. And one of the kings, Charles Emmanuel III, went onto the battlefield and rallied his troops on the front line. And it was really one of the last times that happened. And I think the last king that did that was George II, 9 years or so later than that. And then it was just like kings didn't do that anymore. So that was like another gasp of like a dying world, it seemed like.
Yeah, absolutely. So should heads of state be leading their armies in combat? I mean, this is, you see, certainly the last time it happens for an English monarch there is George II at the Battle of Dettingen in 1743. But if you look across Europe as a whole, I want to say Charles Emmanuel III is certainly part of this last generation. Obviously, Frederick II, this great, quote unquote, Prussian king, that we looked at before, he's fighting all the way through the Seven Years' War and the War of Bavarian Succession. Really, though, I mean, if you look at, I don't know if we want to include Napoleon in this club of, kind of old regime monarchs, right? But he's there, person, leading the troops into battle. Some of the kings who fight against him would like to think that they are there, and certainly they are there at the battles. They're not really running the army themselves anymore. Okay. They're kind of delegating that to generals, but they're there close to the fighting, sort of in the same way that Napoleon is. But yeah, this idea that the head of state should directly lead the army in combat is absolutely going away at this time. So maybe like hand-to-hand combat, it's a sign that things are changing. We're passing from that medieval world into an early modern world, and then sort of further on into a modern world, where, the president or the emperor or, he has something better to do than actually stand there and, get shot at by artillery. This is a sign of how things are changing in terms of the values of armies in the early modern era.
Versus like something in the War of the Roses where you're like, whoever wins the battle, that's our king. Like, very different. And that was another thing too, which it's funny because I kind of came away with these multiple impressions of this dying world, which again is very tragic in some kind of way. But the other thing that you talk about a little bit is kind of the changing makeup of the armies themselves, where you go from these peasants who kind of owed military service to the lord of their land. And now we're starting to move into professional standing armies. And can you just talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is sort of a broader, you know, sort of like Western Civ question, right? I mean, I teach a small college in Ohio. We do this sort of thing we look at in some of my classes. But in the medieval era, it's very common for you to owe your lord a certain number of days of military service per year as part of the feudal system. By the time we get into the 1500s, 1600s, early 1700s, we're really at the end of the 1600s, that is starting to be replaced by mercenary armies. So armies that are, maybe they're all from the same local region, but they're fighting for pay. They're fighting, you know, not necessarily because they have a stake in the outcome of the conflict, although some of them, even at this point, have more of a national identity. But by the time you get, say, to 1650 and afterwards, you start to look a little bit more like the armies that we recognize today. Like America has, you know, a U.S. army that is essentially the property of the state, designed to defend the state. And so to some extent, this happens as a result of the 30 Years' War, which is a very large war of religion in the middle of the 17th century. After that war, a lot of European countries, specifically France and Austria, that we've already mentioned, they start this process of turning their armies from groups of kind of mercenary leaders who kind of run the army into state-run officers who are loyal to the state, not loyal to just whoever is paying. And so as a result, the regiments that they're raising, they still technically belong to the officers. There's a colonel called a colonel proprietor. He basically makes sure that everyone in the unit gets paid, things like this. But the money that he's doing that with comes from the state now. It comes from the government. And so you're transitioning, kind of as you said, from an older kind of peasant feudal model to a mercenary army, and then into a state-run army, somewhat like the professional militaries that we see in the model.
That's a really, really good explanation. I feel like it's kind of this, you're replacing this loyalty to your locality and your village or your town with this kind of delocalized sense of nationalism that eventually comes around in the 20th, or actually the late 19th, mid to late 19th century. So that is really interesting. Okay, I want to talk about muskets for a second. I was really shocked reading your book a little about, there was something that stood out to me where you go, okay, muskets at the time in the 18th century have an accuracy range of about maybe 300 feet or something like that, or in European terms, it's like 90 meters or something.
Sure.
And sometimes you had these soldiers that were twice that distance that were still trying to aim. What, mm-hmm. Was that just like this massive waste of ammunition?
Sure. Yeah, it's a very good question. So I would say, on average, if you're trying to hit an individual man-sized target, the longest examples that I have found of one person trying to aim and fire at someone else with a smoothbore 18th century flintlock musket, actually in combat and hitting them, it's probably about 100 yards. You see references like this at the Battle of Eutaw Springs. So American officers and artillerymen, sort of individual soldiers, not a big battalion of infantry, they're getting picked off by individual British soldiers at that range of about 100 yards.
100 yards, that's 300-ish feet.
Yeah, so about the length of an American football field. So if you're, or for European listeners, a soccer field or a European football field, opposed to about 100 yards. And so that's probably, if you're aiming at an individual, that's probably about as much as you're going to get. But in 18th century warfare, very rarely are you aiming at an individual. You're usually aiming at large lines of men. So a battalion of men is, you know, maybe 100 or 150 files wide. So, you know, again, think of maybe 400 feet wide, and, you know, as tall as a man. So six feet tall, or five feet tall, or 5.5 feet tall. And so you're aiming at this really large target. And so at that distance, you might be able to hit something from a bit further away, maybe 200 yards away or 250 yards away. And so in that sense, when soldiers open fire at these ranges where if they're trying to hit an individual target, you would say, what are you doing, buddy? Like, and it's not just kind of retrospective, us saying that. George Washington hates this. If you read a lot of his letters, he's like, the men are firing at too great a range. They're wasting ammunition. I hate this. Well, this is something that the men think, we don't really need to get closer, because the closer that we get to the enemy, they're going to be able to kid us just as well. So let's stay back here and fire a few shots and maybe see if the enemy leaves. And so very frequently, if you actually read the letters of 18th century soldiers, their officers, you'll find that the men are firing at 300 yards or 250 yards or 150 yards. And if they go beneath that 100-yard range into really where the weapon is pretty accurate and pretty effective, they're usually doing that as part of like a bayonet attack to try and scare off the enemy. Very rarely are there stand-up firefights that last for 20 or 30 minutes at 50 yards or 30 yards. And so, again, the soldiers and their officers are sort of doing this calculus of, you know, what can we do to win the battle? That's why the soul officers all want the men to go and attack with bayonets or, you know, reintroduce the pike or something like this, because they think, man, these muskets are not very accurate or very long range. We can get up there pretty quickly and drive off the enemy. And then we'll win the battle. That's great.
Yeah.
But the soldiers are thinking, wow, if we have to cross that last 100 yards and the enemy's shooting at us and we're not shooting at them, that seems like a really dicey proposition. And so they would much rather stay back, fight.
Yeah. Okay. And that, it seems like you still at that time would have these very rote, kind of very like military formations of like, here you go, you stand in a line, we got these guys behind you that are going to fire. And it seems like it's still very like clockwork almost, you know, and setting people up very strategically. And it's not very precise because of that. It's interesting you bring up George Washington, because I love how you mentioned in your book the British military training manual that was like, wait until you're super, super close, like 150 feet away or 45 meters or something. And like, it's pretty close. And I can't imagine that, you know, that's the training manual, but I can't imagine that actually played out a lot on the field.
Yeah. I mean, so George Washington's a young man. He's in his 20s during the French and Indian War, during that 7 years of war. And at that point, the British Army's philosophy of war was, and a pretty effective philosophy in a lot of ways, we let the other guys fire at a long range. We want to try and get in real close and fire for the first time when all of our muskets are freshly loaded, when all of our guys are ready to shoot. We're going to do a lot of damage at a really close range and hope the enemy runs away. It's a good strategy. Well, Washington grows up in this environment. And that's the philosophy, tactical philosophy, that he wants to try and bring to our army in the Revolutionary War. We want to hold fire until a really close range so that all the guys have their muskets loaded. All the muskets are ready to fire. They're not going to miss fire. We're going to fire one big volley. And at 25 yards, you know, a quarter of a football field, you're going to kill a whole bunch of people and the enemy's going to get panicked and run away.
Yeah.
Well, it's a really good strategy if the men can do it. If the men can actually go out and, you know, hold their fire to that distance, if you have British soldiers with bayonets who are charging down at you, you're going to want to fire with them a lot further away than 25 yards. Because you know that if they're up at 25 yards and you haven't fired yet, man, those bayonets are really close. And we don't want to be close to those bayonets because then we get stabbed. And so as a result, they will usually fire at 100 yards or 150 yards. And George Washington, in a lot of these letters, you can see his frustration. After a couple of key battles, Washington actually writes, it's okay for officers to actually kill the men if they fire too early. Like, we're very frustrated, you know, by the soldiers to fire too early is losing us the battle. At the attack at Stony Point, which is one of these surprise attacks, he says, if any of the soldiers take their musket off of their shoulder, like if, you know, they're marching with it at the shoulder, if they take the musket off their shoulder, it's okay for the officers to kill them because, you know, we don't want to give away the surprise attack. And so, again, kind of in some ways, the core tension the book is trying to examine is the men all want to shoot at a longer distance because they think they have a much better higher probability of survival if they do that. But the officers are actually trying to manage the battle and kind of, you know, keep things moving and win and drive the enemy off. And so the officers' desires and what the men are actually willing to do is often in tension. as a result. You know, intercessionary warfare is really complicated. And it becomes, to some extent, how much can the officers actually control the men on the battlefield, and the officers that can control the men, or who are willing to kind of work with the men and let them fight the way they want, they usually have a little bit more success.
Yeah, that makes sense. And you know, going back to what I was saying about how well you write, there was, without giving too much away or anything, there was a beautiful scene. I mean, it's horrible, but you wrote it beautifully, about this scene. It's very immersive, where you can imagine a soldier in the 18th century, and you've got buckshot coming out of cannons. You got cannonballs. Maybe you see your friend's head get caved in by it, and you've got just absolute destruction of the walls and general environment, and the immense pressure that would create not to fire back. I can't imagine myself not firing back. Like, it's just an automatic thing that would happen.
Yeah, absolutely. Some of the historical writing that inspires me the most are things like Garrett Mattingly's The Armada, where he doesn't quite write in this sort of same dry social science way that's so common in his historical writing, but he tries to put you there. And so in the conclusion of my book, I try and put you there in sort of with an 18th century army on its way into battle. And a lot of the claims that I'm making or sort of with this, what I'm describing is directly from soldiers' accounts, not all the same soldier, but from various soldiers' accounts throughout the 18th century. And so, you know, it's important to back up sort of the picture that you're painting with facts. But I do think trying to write in maybe a more immersive way, is not a horrible thing, and can help, you know, sort of not just other historians, but everybody connect with the past in a more visceral way.
Yeah, yeah, you definitely pulled that off really well. And, you know, even when you talk about daily chores they'd be doing, what's their clothes, and how would you even make bread without an oven, and all of these things is very immersive. You feel like you could maybe get into the heads of these guys. And like you said, it's not just like one location, one country, or one soldier. It's across the board. Okay, so one thing I wanted to ask before I forget is, people might be like, well, arrows have been around for hundreds of years, you know, and people got to duck and cover. So what is the difference? What would the difference be between like this swarm of arrows coming at you and you're ducking and covering versus bullets? How would that be different on the battlefield?
Yeah, absolutely. I will say I'm not a medieval military historian. And so I want to kind of hedge my bets here. There are a lot of people who are going to talk about longbows, who are going to maybe disagree with some things I have to say. And I'm sure they're more right than I am. But if you look at the history of, you know, archers and bows and arrows, normally we go to the English longbowmen from the Hundred Years' War up through the War of the Roses, which is sort of the height of this martial tradition in English culture, where archers are firing these, you know, massive draw-pull bows of yew wood that can fire an arrow a very long distance, very accurately. And it's a very effective weapon. Now, in order to have men like that, you've got to really train them their entire lives. If you need to start training someone at a relatively young age to be able to carefully pull back those massive draw weight bows, and fire them at the enemy. People who have unearthed skeletons from medieval battles, like the Battle of Towton and the War of the Roses, they can tell which skeletons are the longbowmen because their muscles, you know, have kind of almost like deformed their shoulder bones. And so they're really kind of, you know, they're buff guys, right? And so in these battles, it takes a whole lifetime of training to produce a really competent archer, but a longbowman specifically. When you got guns, the drill sergeant can kind of take the guy out behind the woodshed and point him at a target and say, yeah, fire a couple shots and you'll face him, see how it works, and you're good to go. And, you know, it might take 3 years to train a very competent 18th century infantryman, or at least a couple months in order to train a roughly competent 18th century infantryman. But it doesn't require a lifetime of training in the same way that you would need to train a medieval bowman. Or a medieval knight. You know, if you're a man at arms, you're practicing all the time, right? I mean, this is like your full-time job. A relatively small number of them in medieval society, but it's your full-time job. Well, 18th century armies, you can balloon them in size because more and more people without a lot of specialized training can take take part in this type of fighting. And so that's why in the course of the 1500s and 1600s, early firearms, to some extent the crossbow, but early firearms and pikes replace longbowmen as maybe the most common form of battlefield firepower.
So you'd have more bullets than arrows. And so the bullets would be more people ducking and covering and running, and the arrows would be like not as much because you don't have as many archers as
got. Yeah, to some extent. I mean, it's worth saying bullets have a great deal of armor penetration potential, right? So like crossbows, early firearms are very good at smashing their way through armor. English longbows, here I'm drawing on a book called The War of the Roses by John Gillingham. So maybe other people would dispute this claim. But with the type of armor that men-at-arms are wearing in the 1400s, even if you are an English longbowman and you're firing at these men-at-arms who are completely encased in plate armor, you're not going to be able to penetrate that armor. Whereas with an early handgun, maybe you will. So to some extent, arrows are more effective, say, if you're having say the enemy has a whole bunch of crossbowmen and you have a whole bunch of longbowmen, that's great. Your longbowmen probably going to win that fight. If the enemy are knights who are, you know, all on horseback or slowed down because of the mud or something like that, you might do a lot of attritional damage as they come in. But then medieval battles, by and large, are going to be decided by hand-to-hand combat.
Okay.
The archery might be decisive, but there's still going to be some hand-to-hand combat. By the time you get into the 18th century, the musketry maybe is reducing the likelihood that there's going to be hand-to-hand combat. That's how effective it is.
That's really cool. Okay, so that answers a lot of that question, actually. And before we go, I just wanted to comment that I love how you brought up the Battle of Culloden in Scotland and how there were still some sort of melee hand-to-hand combat, just because I'm a major Outlander fan, and I'm sure there are a lot of history lovers that are really big Outlander fans. And Battle of Culloden. Yeah. So, okay. Also, I wanted to let everybody know that your book, it just came out like a few days ago, I believe, December 30.
Yeah. Still getting ready to ship, hopefully, on Amazon. Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Yeah. So very soon you'll be able to find it on Amazon. And were you working on anything after that's going to come out later?
Yeah, absolutely. So my next book is specifically on George Washington's army. It's called Firm Battalions in American Fire, the Continental Army and Military Europe. And I really look at the way that America's first army, George Washington's Continental Army, understood its combat role and its experience through what European soldiers were doing in sort of the contemporary period.
Nice.
And to some extent, I do that through the figure of Steuben or Baron Steuben. He's an important Prussian guy who comes over to sort of train our army in the middle years of the war. He's also the mascot of my university. And so as a result, I'm hoping I'll get tenure as a result of writing a book about him. That's my next major project is specifically focusing on our army in America.
That is really cool. Well, again, thank you, Dr. Alexander S. Burns. Thank you so much for joining us and happy new year. And I hope to talk to you later about your other book.
Sounds great, Emily. Thanks so much for having me on.
Thanks. Bye.